Greetings, Frowner. Welcome back.
Greetings. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Oh, good. Thank you. Good. Thank you. Emily just made me some waffles. And before
Oh,
our interview,
nice.
I was hoping that I could enjoy some waffles with you and tidbits
Yeah,
about our
certainly.
lives.
Certainly. You're in the morning, I'm in the evening.
Oh,
So you have
nice.
some waffles, and I'll have some Vasco da Gama port wine.
Wow.
It's do you say manufactured, distilled, produced here in Goa, India? You know Vasco da Gama, the historical figure?
Yeah, that guy.
I didn't know him until I came to India, but there's like cities named after him and stuff here. It's weird.
Wow. I didn't
Cheers.
know that either. Cheers.
So you are working on a book, or is that a secret?
I wouldn't call it a secret. I am working on a book. I'm not sure. So the plan originally was, so okay, let me. So you got the three books of Occult Philosophy by Agrippa, right?
Right. There was
And
a really nice episode of Esoterica that just came out, I think less than a day ago, where he broke down like one of the problems of academia is that occultism and magic are completely disregarded and ignored when they have had a profound effect on Western thinking. I think they're by the religious, they're rejected as, heretical, scary, satanic, whatever. And by the secular, more atheistic, generally speaking, not everybody, they're rejected as hocus pocus, weird stuff. So basically, neither the religious scholars nor the academic scholars are studying Agrippa in college. Maybe not in most colleges, but anyway, I'm interrupting you.
No, it's
But
okay.
yeah, he had a great piece about that, kind of a call to folks like yourself. I'm going to put a link to that right here, so you can watch that later when you're watching this. And anyway, so continue, please. I'll stop interrupting.
Sure. Okay. So, all right. So the three books, they're a compilation, right? He took they're not obviously a compilation upon on like first read, but the more you get to know it, the more you can see that it's a compilation of thought, right?
Right.
And really, like, the only way to discover that is to know about the sources that Agrippa was using, because he doesn't. So Agrippa is a much more subtle writer than he first appears to be, because he, I mean, well, sometimes he is explicitly subtle, where like he describes, like he when he describes like the piety that he's looking for in like what I'll call an Agrippan magician, he says things like, he says things like you're, the family must be devout, devout, pious. They must be confessed every Saturday. Like he's very specific on details, and he lays them out just, like nakedly. Like he just says, okay, you need to do this thing, this thing, this thing, right? So in some ways, like he's very explicit, and he's very like detailed and exacting. But the way that he is, he's exacting in a very different way, in other parts of the book. So what he does is he's actually quoting from, in all sorts of different places in the book, he's quoting from other authors, and carefully rewording some of what they're saying. So for example, he talks about, so right in the beginning of the book, it's like book one, chapter two or something. He talks
like
about
rewording like a high school kid who doesn't want to get busted for copy pasting from Wikipedia, or rewording in a way that he's improving upon the original material and interjecting his own spin.
he's refocusing it. It's the second one.
Right.
He's refocusing it. So he'll do things like in book one, chapter two, he'll say that the magician must have, oh man, I don't have any quotes prepared, but
oh, that's okay.
Yeah, he talks
that's
about
why they call
how,
it picking your brain.
right. Yeah. He'll talk about how you need like an Agrippan, what I'm calling an Agrippan magician again, will need to have what he calls natural philosophy, an understanding of the natural world, an understanding of taxonomy. They'll need to have mathematics. And he's saying he explicitly says that the reason why you need mathematics is so that you can calculate celestial timing. Like that's why he has that in there. And then you need divinity, right? You need this, you need an overall, like overall, this like concept, of theology and just being a God-fearing person. So those are like the three themes of the three books that he gets into before. So you can see, like, it's pretty much at that idea is like one of the ideas at the root of the three books. But the important thing to know there is that he got his idea from somebody else. Sort of. So he in that concept of saying, okay, in order to be this thing, in order to be called this thing, you have to have these requisite skills, right? He's indirectly quoting from this earlier medieval book of Curiosa called the Mirabilum Mundi, the miracle wonders of the world, right? Which is an anonymous work that is attributed to Albertus the Great. And in this work, that work says that you need to have rhetoric. It says that you need to have like rhetoric, magic, and mathematics, or something like that, to be a magician, right? So he's taking the same idea, but he's changing things very carefully. He's specifically, he changes the logic concept to a divinity concept. He's changing things, or he's using the same framework as other authors, but he's carefully rewording things so that it points more to his idea. Right. So those are the sorts of things he's doing. He's changing quotes without explicitly quoting anybody in order to stay within the same framework that he's arriving in.
Right.
Does that make sense? So he's like indirectly quoting from this stuff, but you're never going to know unless you're intimately familiar with things like Wonders.
Now, wasn't one of Agrippa's primary teachers Johannes Trithemius, or Johannes Trithemius?
Nobody really knows. Like, So he was, Trithemius was an abbot in this place called Sponheim. And in 1510, so this is kind of cool. In 1510, Agrippa sent Trithemius an early draft of the three books. And if you ever actually look at the draft is like, it's different from the eventual three books. Like all of the stuff that he says in it, it's pretty much the same theme, but everything is like cribbed, right? And he sent him a handwritten manuscript. And we know that he sent him a handwritten manuscript because Sponheim still has that manuscript. So it's possible to like view that manuscript and compare it to the three books, right? So in 1510, he writes to Trithemius and he's like, I have this idea for a book, essentially. And he like he sends them a draft of the book. Trithemius writes back to him and he's like, writing this book is a bad idea. And then, and like, you know, and he says, like, not to say that you're not a smart guy, because obviously you are a smart guy.
Well, I don't know if by then, I know Trithemius at one point was writing, he had some trouble with being accused of being a black magician or being accused of being in league with the devil and all this kind of stuff. But he was a devoutly religious man who just was interested, and I mean, very deeply interested in a lot of this occult philosophy. And so I was wondering if maybe he, maybe he influenced Agrippa a little bit to bring in a little bit more of the divinity, a little bit more of the piousness, the, you know, because the Benedictine abbot, he was, you know, very pious in his approach. And especially the, when he was writing later, you know, explaining the only magic that I practice is the magic of the love of Christ, which is kind of an interesting turn of phrase, because you know, you and I know you could be doing all kinds of magic and, you know, but it's the magic of the love of Christ. If that's where it's coming from, if that's where it's centered, it doesn't mean you're not drawing pentagrams and calling on, you know, spirits and things like that. It just means that you're not doing it for the devil or something.
The, So it's super interesting. He so he writes to Trithemius, and Trithemius is like, he has a cool attitude toward actually like writing this book, right? In 1510, this happens. The book's not published till 1531. So for 21 years, Agrippa is just like continually revising this thing. He's expanding on it. He's taking books that he reads and he's adding to the three books.
So it's a very early draft that's in Sponheim.
Right, exactly. And like you know, so Agrippa spends decades like just writing this thing, right? And if you look at Book One, Chapter Three, I believe it's Chapter Three. Chapter Three is like the hardest chapter to understand because it's written enigmatically. Right. That chapter is based on Trithemius's writing. There's a famous book that Trithemius had published by then called
Steganographia
Secundaeus. It's basically this book that's talking about the Trithemius had ideas about the astrological ages of the world, right? And so he like writes all this stuff out, and mostly he's known for that. But in certain editions of that book, there are several letters that are published, like St. Paul style letters that Trithemius wrote to specific people, right? And in one of those letters, Trithemius writes this. He writes out this enigma. Agrippa takes this enigma and again he rewords it to fit within the framework that Agrippa is building up.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, just in the interest of, I think I'm going to call this episode "The Occult." Possibly.
Whoa. That's so dark and mysterious.
Yeah. So I just kind of want to, you know, work in here. Now, wasn't Robert Flood the person who was credited with inventing the Ouija board? Was he not also in this same small circle of friends with Agrippa and Trithemius?
Flood? I don't know when Flood. I think Flood came along later.
Okay. I thought that he was like a fellow student of Trithemius or something.
It could be. The big Agrippa came along right at the end of this like this set of like who are now occult titans, right? So
Right.
like he came along right at the end of like Trithemius. He came along at the end of like Marsilio Ficino. Pico della Mirandola had just been executed. Like he comes Agrippa comes along in this like crazy time, and he when he first wrote the three books in 1510, the world was still Martin Luther hadn't come along yet. By the time he publishes it in 1531, it's like Martin Luther has come along, and like Protestantism is like
There's like
grown
already
across Europe.
five different denominations of radical reformation, and all the
Right, yeah.
Anabaptists are gathering. The violent Anabaptists are gathering in Munster, preparing for the end of the world that's supposed to take place in 1534 or something. And everything was going wild by
Everything's wild at the
1530s.
Yeah. And he definitely like Agrippa had friends. Like he definitely had he had friends and he had patrons. Later he didn't have any patrons, which was the cause, which was one of the causes of his later deterioration, was that he didn't have any buddies to pay the bills. But like he definitely had his circles, you know. Much like later
And
magicians, like
Paracelsus was one of the people in contemporaries, right?
yeah, Paracelsus was around at the same time.
And isn't he credited as being the father of modern medicine? Or am
Yeah.
I
No,
misremembering?
you're right on there. Paracelsus was this like he was sort of this maverick who like so the cool thing about Paracelsus is that like instead of getting into what other people had to say about the occult generally, Paracelsus just went directly back to nature. And he was just naturally talented enough that he could do that he could just go to nature spirits and ask them questions. And so like as a doctor, as a doctor, he was learning things directly from nature. And so like that's why Paracelsus is both like such like a striking author, right? Like why he contrasts so much with other stuff happening at the time. And then also why his influence is so lasting, because he was so prolific, because he could just go directly to whatever he was dealing with
There's
and
this
learn
interesting
things.
book, The Cosmic Serpent by Jeremy Narby. I think I'm pronouncing that right. But anyway, he was interested in the fact that so many pharmaceutical cures, so many, the chemical, the active ingredient in pills that treat this or that comes from the bark of this particular tree. And where did you find that out? Well, we found that out from the shamans. And so he went to Peru. This was before everybody and their dog goes to Peru at some point in their life to take ayahuasca. This was a bit before that just became standard practice for hipsters. So he went there and he asked the shaman, "How do you know which plants do what?" And he said, "You ask the plants." And so he says, "How do you ask the plants? I mean, how do you understand the plants? How do the plants answer you when you ask them?" And he says, "Well, you have to take the ayahuasca." And so eventually the shaman talked him into taking it, and then he was walking around talking to the plants. And it's a fun book. It's worth checking out. But that's probably,
Cool.
I imagine, maybe not exactly how Paracelsus did it. Maybe he was more naturally open to nature spirits and that kind of thing,
Well,
receiving
I
that
don't
kind of
know. I
information.
really don't.
Maybe.
Because right, like by the time that Paracelsus comes along, you like South America has been discovered at any rate.
Oh, that's true.
So did like how much of European occult, that's a super interesting question that I have no idea what the answer to that is. Like to what extent does South American native native religion influence European occultism.
That, yeah, that's really interesting.
Because
Well, we
like
know
you always
chocolate had a big impact, and I guess there was like the kings would drink the chocolate on the full moon or something, and then the Portuguese came and they were like, this is, yeah, and it didn't even have sugar in it. They were drinking dark chocolate. He who asked me to go get some dark chocolate the other day, and I accidentally got the 98% dark chocolate, and we're both like eating it like, oh, I'm like, this is what chocolate taste, this is what the Portuguese tasted and went, oh my God, this is so good. I'm like, what? They
What
didn't
were
even
they
mix
eating
in sugar or
otherwise?
anything. Oh yeah, exactly. They were just eating like stale beef jerky, I guess. Someone gave them dark chocolate or cocoa bean, like a hot chocolate. They had like a hot chocolate drink. I don't know, maybe they mixed something else with it besides water and cocoa beans, but so they brought it back to Europe, and then it became all the rage with the rich people, the kings, and then gradually it worked its way down to the upper middle class, and then Hershey came along and was like, I have an idea, let's
It
make
could
this.
also.
And so then everybody was eating like fancy Portuguese in the 1400s, or 1500s, whatever.
I mean, maybe like maybe it's like, so have you ever heard about this, about how I don't know if this is still true, but when I was growing up, the olive oil that you could get in America tastes like radically different from the olive oil that you could get in Europe. And part of the reason for it was shipping. Like they would put it in like metal containers, and then the metal containers would make the olive oil taste different. But then the other reason was because they knew that Europeans had a refined palate for olive oil, and Americans didn't have that.
So they gave
So
us
they could,
the
yeah, they could give us
crappy,
like oil of any quality, and we would be like, this is delicious, because we didn't know any better. So I wonder if like chocolate was the same way. Like, were the Inca like,
maybe.
give those guys like the dog food grade chocolate, because they won't know the
Maybe
difference.
in the beginning, before they started, growing that and coffee and everything else in mass in horrible ways. Yeah. Hopefully the noise pollution won't be too bad. I need to turn on my AC a little bit, because
How hot is
this,
it
I
there?
insist on wearing this. No, it's like fine. It's just that you remember being in the temple. Were you ever like a hierophant or a major officer?
Yeah, sure.
So I'm wearing an under robe, an outer robe, and an outer robe.
Oh.
So it's that same kind of thing as like when you're the heiress, and even
Yeah.
if it's not hot, you're still
It's
kind of,
hot anyway. Yeah.
yeah.
We should write
I don't know why I do.
a modern
Yeah.
grimoire and say that the first thing that is required is an air conditioner.
I think that, because it started in London, that I mean, for one thing, when everything smells like backed up sewage and coal smoke, it makes a lot of sense to have your spiritual practice be indoors with a ton of incense and just candlelit. I mean, I think it was cold more than it was comfortable there, so it made sense for them to have a cloak and an outer cloak and this kind of thing. But then same thing with my Buddhist monk's robe that I wear in Buddhist Books podcast. It's kind of designed for the Himalayas. It's designed for like being like way up in altitude and far north, and so here I am in tropical, like humid and warm, wearing this like thick, like raw silk, Oh my God, it's
What
really
do they
silly.
wear? What do they wear around you? Like what do Southern Buddhist monks wear?
Oh, well, that's like a different sort of denomination. I think I haven't really looked at the fabric, but I imagine it's a bit thinner. But this is like the Tibetan monks, I think they wear similar fabric down, wherever they are, as what they wear in the Himalayas. The robe that I have specifically is from Bhutan, so it's all snowy and mountainous there. Yeah, there's a variety of, depending on the denomination, different types of monk robe. This is a Nyingma shawl, so it's technically for like the people who are halfway between a lay person and a monk. So you can have a family and you don't have to take a vow of chastity and poverty and all that. It's not strictly speaking a monk not in the monastic sense. It's referred to as a non-monastic monk. But I was ordained directly by my ego, rather than any particular lineage. Actually, I bought it. I was inspired to buy it, and it just stayed in a drawer for years. And like I never would have. Whenever I thought about like putting it on, I was thinking, no, cultural appropriation, man. That's no joke. And then eventually, being away from California for long enough I started to be like, ah, fuck it. I'm gonna put this thing on. And all the Buddhists from Tibet and people in India are like, oh, that's great. Sometimes someone will say, sorry, are you ordained? And I'll say no. And they'll go, oh, okay. Like nobody gives a shit. Nobody's like, how dare you? Yeah, like I can tell from the analytics that basically nobody from US or basically the Western world, nobody watches. They see a white guy in a Buddhist monk's robe, they're already clicking away. But everybody in Nepal and Northeast India and Bhutan and places like that's where everybody watches from. So it's like, okay, yeah. I mean, the whole idea was to get into the Theravadan scriptures that are kind of glossed over by a lot of Mahayana and Vajrayana and Zen folks that are just kind of like, eh, yeah. But that's like the Buddha, like Siddhartha Gautama, his teachings and the order he set up. And even if there's other things that have developed more recently that are more useful, I still would like to dive into what was it like 2,600 years ago? What were they doing? What was the situation? What were the teachings? What were the rules? How did their commune work? Since he was actually from the region where that all went down, and so when we go to visit her family, and I'm kind of like, we're on a road from Bodh Gaya to Rajgir, and I'm like, oh, Lord Buddha must have walked from there to there, when he was starting his ministry, and all this kind of stuff. So I don't know, maybe it's missing the point of like being detached and all this, but I kind of like the curiosity of it, the socio-anthropology of it, the tactileness of feeling the dirt and like looking at the plants and kind of knowing, when I read about Udayan and his shenanigans and how many times he'd be inappropriate and get punished. It was probably he was in a hut like the one right over there, and that kind of thing. Like, I don't know. I'm into that, but not everybody's
That
into
would be
that.
a
But anyway,
super,
yeah.
that would be like a super cool book to write, I think. Would be like this, like all you'd be doing is just like quoting from the original, like the original stuff that was written
Making
down
it a
from who was teaching,
story. Yeah.
and
Yeah, yeah.
taking those stories and then just going around the area and being like, he was probably in a hut just like this. He was wearing these clothes that they still wear over here. He was by
Right.
this tree, because
Yeah,
sometimes
yeah.
like the Bodhi tree's still there, right? And so like
Well, yeah, a descendant of it. Yeah.
a descendant of it,
Yeah,
exactly.
yeah.
And so
That's what they
like you could
say
go
anyway.
you can go to see it, and
Yeah.
you know, and so you could present those different stories in the context of the world around you.
Yeah.
I think that what you're doing is like in a sense, like you're developing such a deep sense of Buddhism, right? Because you're
Yeah.
going like you're digging deep into the foundations, and you're like, okay, what's in here, and how do I
Yeah.
relate to this, you know? Because like there's this whole almost academic or intellectual aspect. It's like esoteric intellectualism that's part of occultism that you don't see every day. Oh, did I lose you? Are you still there?
Am I here?
You're here. Yep.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I see it a little bit like the Christians or the Muslim folks who go to Mecca. You know, that's like part of being Muslim, and Christians who go to Jerusalem and walk the Via Dolorosa, and so on and so forth. But Buddhism is much more of a practice or a philosophy. But there are pilgrims. When I go to these places, it's not like I'm the only one there. There's people from Korea and all over, Asia especially, who are visiting the places where different events happen in the life of Lord Buddha. And so yeah, it's fun. But yeah, reading through all these the boring parts that everybody says to skip aren't actually so boring. I mean, they are. I mean, like the thing is, they're like 90% boring, but in that 10% that's not boring, there's some stuff that I have never heard before. And it's more reliable than anything from Mahayana, Vajrayana, or Zen, as far as if you're talking about the historical Buddha. Not to say that there's no validity in the teachings of Mahayana, Vajrayana, and Zen. It's just that the validity comes from, Chinese monks in the 6th century Common Era, as opposed to Lord Buddha in the 6th century before Common Era. But I mean, ultimately, that's kind of like, and I've had to kind of come face to face with that, especially kind of coming to terms with, oh, he was sexist. Like, oh, he was kicking people out for having, deformities or being crippled or, being deaf and blind and all that. This is kind of disappointing. This is actually a little bit Nazi-ish, like I've had to kind of process that, but then kind of like come back around to like, not only was it a different time, but one of the reasons, and he stated this, was he wanted his order. He wanted these teach He thought these teachings were valuable. He thought that people could actually use these teachings. And supposedly Brahma appeared before him and said, "You must build an order that will last, and your teachings are very valuable." And he was like, okay, because he didn't want to teach. But anyway, that's the story anyway. And so his motivation was to make sure that the order lasted a long time. And so he kind of didn't want people to show up and say, "Hey, I might be interested in joining," and then see a leper and a crippled person and, a deaf person trying to teach, and then they'd walk away, and then his order might shrivel out and go away entirely. I mean, that's how one way that a person can justify like why he would do that back then. And also, like a lot of the rules he established were prompted by the fact that just random people in the neighborhood were talking about it. They would say, "How can a monk walk with a woman? What's going on here? Aren't you supposed to be holy or whatever? Like, you're just walking with a woman having a conversation." So Lord Buddha would say, "No walking with women having conversations." And it's kind of like, why, you know, like, you know, this isn't enlightened, you know. And so in that sense, it's kind of, I can understand why people say to skip the rules. They just kind of like, yeah, just be a decent person. It's common sense stuff. But if you actually get down into it, like some of it is like, oh, this is really interesting. Like he says, don't dig in the ground because you don't know how many single faculty, like single sense, one sense, the sense of touch, sentient beings, he calls them, people, he calls them at certain points, or whatever the Pali word that gets translated into English is. You don't know how many people you're displacing or confusing or harming or killing by digging in the ground. So don't dig in the ground. And it's like, wow, he's taking, you know, animal rights to a whole new level. But then he also says, if somebody offers you meat, be grateful, eat it. And but don't go back to their house the next day and say, hey, you got any more of that meat? You know, like that's where he draws the line, you know, is, you know, don't request it. Don't, you know, if somebody says, hey, what are you hungry for? Don't say, I'd like some chicken. Could you go hook that up for me? Like that's no, you that's you're crossing a line there. You don't get kicked out, but you get reprimanded, you know, for doing that. So it's interesting, like finding out like exactly where that line is, because a lot of vegans and vegetarians will say, well, Buddha was vegan. How can the Dalai Lama be Buddhist if he eats meat? And it's like, well, technically, if it was given to him,
then it's fine.
Or Buddha would be okay with it. Yeah, yeah. But in his case, I guess he grew up eating it, and then he tried to be vegetarian for a while, and he just didn't feel right, felt sick, felt like his brain wasn't working, so he went back to eating pork. And so that's kind of controversial for a lot of people. It's like, really? The head of the religion? And I mean, he's the head of one of the four main branches of monastic Tibetan Buddhism, but if you ask kind of the local, you know, random person on the street in Nepal, they'll say he's the king of Buddhism. And it's like, I'm like, no, he's not. he's not any, like, such of the imagination, the king of, he's an exiled king of a country. Like there is no king of Buddhism.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Like, well, it's interesting.
Not the Pope, like, you know. Well, he kind of is the Pope, I guess, but yeah.
Right. And that's what I was thinking. Like
yeah,
you could
yeah.
say that the Pope is the king of the Vatican, and like, that's a perfectly,
right.
like in a sense, that's a perfectly valid thing to say. You know what I mean?
But because, a lot of people think of him as kind of the king of Christianity. I mean,
right.
you know, people who are traditional Roman Catholics specifically would think of him that way. They wouldn't call him right. that, but I think they think of him that way.
Yeah. 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 It's challenging, right? It's challenging for Americans to hear things like that, because we're so like, you know, like
oh,
if
yeah,
they
we
are
don't like kings. Yeah.
We don't like kings. And so it's like
yeah.
to hear that the leader of a religion is the king of that religion is difficult for us, because that means that the king of the religion can take our rights away. You know?
Right, yeah. The only king we like in America is Martin Luther King.
We also
really
like
yeah.
We also like Don King and other assorted criminals.
Are you saying Martin Luther King is a criminal?
No. No, I'm not saying that.
He was on the FBI watch list, but I think that's more of an indictment
yeah.
of the FBI than
right. Yeah. I don't even know for sure that Don King was a criminal. He probably was, but I don't even know where I got that. But
I've been reading the lectures of Martin Luther. It's been really fun on chicken philosophy. It's gotten to the point where people were inspired by him, and they started rioting and smashing statues and interrupting Catholic masses and forcing nuns to marry. And so he's come out of hiding, and he's giving these lectures to a group of rebels, of these like rebel Christians. And he's telling them, don't force nuns to get married. You know, like if a nun wants to get married, then she should. And he says a vow of chastity is worth the same as if I say, I swear to God, I am going to punch my father in the face, and then I don't do it. That's God will be just as mad about that as he will be for a nun that breaks her vow of chastity to become a wife and mother. And so he's very funny. Like he makes these interesting jokes and stuff. And there's things that obviously are very, very dated. Like he just very casually, you know, will talk about, you know, Jews and this and that in a way that's kind of cringe from today's perspective. But putting yourself into the head of 1522, it's like, well, yeah, that's kind of how they were thinking back then. But like not in like a Hitler-y way, but in like a religious analyzing the law of Moses versus the salvation of, you know, that kind of thing. The same stuff you hear at church, actually.
That reminds me
It's
of
funny.
there was this so I had this teacher once who he was an astrology teacher, and he had whatever. He was very wise. He had lots of pearls of wisdom. Sometimes he was wrong, sometimes, most times, he had some really wise things to say. And he told me about this. It's a famous book, of the Protestant persuasion called True Christianity. It's by a guy named Johann Arndt, I believe. And there is so my teacher claimed that there was an edition of True Christianity that had a whole section on how to work with your like if you're a priest, how to work with your congregation astrologically.
Oh, interesting.
Which isn't like when he first told me about it, I was like, wow, that's radical. But like it actually isn't as radical as it sounds, because astrology was used so much in medicine, right? And because it was just used like
All
all the
right.
time as
Well,
like this.
farming.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah. And so using it to, you know, using it to know better how to preach to people, like, it sort of made sense. Anyway, I never found the edition that he was talking about. Like the one that he referred me to didn't have that in. And I was like, which edition is it? And he was like, no, it's in there. And then I didn't find it. I mean, like,
Interesting.
yeah. For all I know, like maybe it was actually there. I just didn't know how to read at the time. He was one of the people who taught me how to read, like who taught me how to like deeply extract things, like dredge what you're reading, look for the context, look for the things that you don't understand, you know, and you know, dig into the sources of what they're talking about. He was the sort of person that would like take one thing and then read it for like 2 years and get everything that he could out of it, rather than read many things in a surface way.
My dad was an English professor, and he wrote something that was very interesting that basically, and he was dyslexic, so it's kind of extra interesting, his advice to actively read. So it was kind of the way that he read in order to overcome his dyslexia. You know, to start the sentence, like as soon as you start the sentence, start to ask yourself, where is this sentence going? And see if you can predict where the sentence is going to end and what the point of it is. And then when you're finished with the sentence, reflect on how maybe you were right or maybe you were wrong, and why were you wrong? You know, it's like, wow, like that's, I mean, because I'm you know, I'll space out and just be like, oh, I just read half a page. And that's part of the reason why I read things online is into a camera. It's like it increases my attention span, and then I hear myself read it, and then I actually absorb the information a lot better than if I just try to like absorb, you know, read the page and be, would you just read? Oh shit, I don't know. They would say, I think the word the was there a few times, you know. But yeah, so that was pretty interesting. But anyway.
So you have so many you have so many images around you, so many figures.
I try to break the first commandment as often and in as many ways as possible. So yeah, I've got two. I don't know if I'm pointing. There's Ganesh up here, and there's another Ganesh down here. I've got several Buddhas, as they say in Mahayana and Vajrayana. In Theravada or original Buddhism, there's the Buddha, of course. And then, well, okay, so in pre-sectarian early Buddhism, there's a difference. So pre-sectarian early Buddhism means when he was alive and there was only one group, and there was no schisming allowed, right? And then after he passed away, then the schisms started. And then but then they'd have these councils, sort of like in the Catholic Church, they have ecumenical councils. So they had the first council, then the second council, and then King Ashoka, of Magad, which is present day Bihar, converted. He conquered from, you know, the far side of Pakistan to the near side of China, almost all the way down to the tip of southern India. And he conquered this huge territory. And then he felt bad because there was so much death and so much violence involved in him becoming the emperor of, you know, the known universe, or the emperor of India. And so he became devoutly Buddhist, and he rejected violence, and so he started encouraging Buddhism and building these Buddhist pillars. The Pillar of Ashoka, that's what this is. It's in present day, this is a nationalist symbol of the Indian country that exists post 1948. But
nationalist, also, how? Like nationalist as in like America has the American flag?
Yeah, this is like, it's a military, like you know, salute. There's the national anthem might play while a flag is waving, and you might see the Pillar of Ashoka. So yeah, that kind of thing. So like what, like the Great Seal of the United States kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's actually it's the spitting image of the ancient Pillar of Ashoka, who was the emperor who became the Buddhist emperor. And so he built these all over, and there's even one in what is considered China, not, you know, China occupied Tibet, actual China. I mean, you know, what the country previously known as China before they annexed Tibet as well. And of course, you know, Tibet. And so, yeah, a lot of he spread Buddhism everywhere. And he also had the third council of Buddhism under him, like he sponsored it. So he was basically, you might say, the Constantine of early Buddhism, just in that way, not in every way, but in there is some resemblance, you know, Constantine to Christianity, Ashoka to Buddhism. And so then they codified, but then there was like, by then, a person might want to build a temple and become a high-ranking, respectable Buddhist for other reasons besides the genuine heart's thirst for freedom from the bondage of attachment that leads to suffering. You know, things like maybe being in good with the emperor, kind of thing. You know what I mean? You know, like greed and lust for power become motivators to be as impressively Buddhist as possible, you know. And so, I mean, and other things, and, you know, like and then there were 14 different orders that were all claiming to be the original order. And so then a few hundred years after that, then this Lotus Sutra appears that basically is like, and then Lord Buddha said, forget everything I said before, Let me tell you the real stuff. It's called Mahayana Buddhism. And so I read this and
What?
I was like rolling my eyes. I'm like, I want to be respectful of this, but it's just so infuriatingly stupid, you know. And one day I will come back around to it, and I really sincerely want to not feel the way that I do about the Lotus Sutra. But it
Are
was
you
the
saying that the Lotus Sutra is like the Book of Mormon in Buddhism?
yes, and
How?
that's the reason I bought all that. I bought the whole Tipitaka of pre-sectarian early Buddhism, all these books back here. Was because of how much I didn't like the Lotus Sutra, and because
Wow.
it's saying, you know, I what, forget what I all I know is Dhammapada, this th thin little book, and then I looked into it, and it's like, well, this there's all this, so it's saying just forget all this and just focus on, you know, this father figure Buddha who wants the best for you and will teach you through pictures and symbols. And it's like, okay, you
I
know,
don't know about that.
I appreciate the canning and exporting of olive oil, for instance, you know, like it did well outside. It did well in Thailand and China. Everywhere Mahayana went, people were like, what do I do? It's just that. Okay, you know, like, and because it's much more like it's already it's what do the communists say about capitalism? Late stage. It's like late stage Buddhism. And so the scriptures are you know, some of the scriptures are talking about like, oh, those monks, they're just a bunch of hypocrites and they're just obsessed with their stupid rules. The real, you know, path is to be the lay follower. And to be a very sincere lay follower is to be better than one of those hypocrite Pharisee, you know, like, so it's kind of like that. It's like a development on, you know, and maybe they're legitimate complaints of you know, what by then was a 700-year-old religion. But still, I want to get back and learn that original religion that maybe became bloated after 700 years, requiring necessitating Mahayana to come along. And well, anyway, so okay, all of that to say that this is Amitabha Buddha, who I haven't gotten to yet. I don't know who that is because I'm insisting on going in order by century. And so, you know, sometimes a little piece of information kind of like accidentally goes into my brain about something Mahayana or Vajrayana, and I am like every 10 episodes of Buddhist books, I read a little bit of Mahayana. I mean, I read a little bit of Vajrayana. Actually, every 5 now, I'm alternating Japanese Vajrayana and Tibetan Vajrayana, and it's very interesting because sometimes the Japanese Vajrayana, I mean, it's a like a German guy, I think, that's done a whole bunch of research, and he's like putting it all very succinctly, and so it's very blunt. Where the Tibetan, I mean, what I'm reading in particular is like this poetic, epic life story of Padmasambhava, who was the scholar monk who was born in present-day Pakistan, and eventually later in life, after he had mastered all these things, he went to Tibet and brought Vajrayana to Tibet. And there were other monks that brought Vajrayana to Tibet, but he was the one that they decided to called the second Buddha, and make big statues of them everywhere and stuff like that. And so anyway, so he Padmasambhava is over here somewhere on the left side, and in the middle is Vimalamitra, who was one of the other Tibetan scholar monks. I mean, one of the other Indian scholar monks who went to Tibet bringing Vajrayana. Anyway, so yeah, so then there's I don't know if you can see, there's a little wooden version of see, this is Mahabodhi Temple. So this is right here is where the Bodhi tree is, in Bodh Gaya. See, Lord Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree is right here,
Was
and
that
so
temple
that's
there
Temple
when
of
he was
Buddha.
sitting there?
No. It was
Okay.
built to commemorate it, and so yeah. And they say that the Bodhi there is a Bodhi tree there, and they say that it's from a seed, from the tree, from the seed, from the tree of the original one. But it's kind of like, really? It's like how sometimes, I think, I have just as much skepticism about, is that what Jesus really said? Like that. But
Yeah, I know you.
then Guru Nanak. So I think it was, I want to say the 1500s, but it might have been the 1400s, I'm not sure. Guru Nanak, he was the founder. Basically, he lived in what's now called Punjab, the state, and the language that they speak there, their word for disciple is Sikh. So his disciples were known as the Sikhs, and or the Sikh. And so he had specific teachings and specific songs and specific practices, and he caused quite a controversy because he was neither Hindu nor Muslim in a time when you were either Hindu or Muslim. Basically, the Muslims were in charge; they were the emperors, and he agreed with aspects of Islam and Hinduism, but he disagreed with other things about him, and he had his very strong ideas. And according to tradition, he like disappeared for 3 days and then reappeared. And he said that he was God. He became one with God, and now he's returned to teach everybody. And then he chose a guru before he died. He said, "You're going to be the guru after me." And then that went on for 10 gurus like that. And by the 10th guru, it was like a warrior guru, Guru Gobind Singh. And they had to endure a lot. They were being persecuted quite a lot. They were being tortured during a century when a lot of, I mean, not to diminish, but everybody was being tortured back then. Like in Europe, the Anabaptists were being tortured in worse ways. I mean, well, okay, what's worse? Being drawn and quartered, and slowly, all these different things, or boiled in oil. It's like, six to one, half a dozen to the other. But that seemed to be the century when a lot of people were being tortured to death. And so the Sikhs, the loyal Sikhs, were being tortured to death under the emperor in India at the time. And they were praying, like they were being told to renounce their faith. And with their very last breaths, as they're being boiled in oil, they're praying, they're singing. And so that's like, so yeah, so what he started turned into a really intense thing. And then the very last of the 10 gurus, I mean, he wasn't the last, because he said he put together, he codified, I mean, there were three gurus, the last three gurus, I think, were codifying the teachings all into one book. And so the 10th guru said, "After I die, your guru will be this book." And so that's how Sikhism, as it is today, was born. And occasionally you have someone come along and say, "Oh, actually, I'm a guru, and I'm going to start a new religion. It's called Kundalini Yoga," or whatever. And they're technically, heretical, according to a strict Sikh, perspective. But yeah, they sing the Sikh songs, and then Beverly Hills, and drive around in Rolls Royces, whatever. It's who am I to judge? So yeah, so he's there. Yeah, and so yeah, my main the main five. I don't know if you can see. There's Amitabha Buddha, and then there's Mahavira. He was the 24th Tirthankara of Jainism. And behind him is Parshvanatha, the 23rd Tirthankara of Jainism. And
What's a
so we've got
Tirthankara?
Tirthankara, funny you should ask, is a spiritual ford. By that, of course, I mean the car. No, it means like the river between the mortal world of suffering and reincarnation, and the other side, which is the other side of the river, is enlightenment. And so the ford is the place where you can walk across the river safely without being swept away by the current. And so the Tirthankaras are the ford finders, the ford makers, the spiritual ford. So one of the famous the Heart Sutra, the short version, it ends with gyate gyate hara gyate. That's the Japanese version. To the other side, to the other side, enlightenment, you know, talking about gone, gone, gone to the other shore. And so that's basically what a Tirthankara is. And Mahavira was a contemporary with Lord Buddha. And back then there were like 61 of these guys. And
Whoa,
but they were all very
61
different.
Tirthankaras or 61
No,
like,
61 different religions that were all
oh,
similar,
okay,
going on in the
yeah.
same area. And so one of them was Mahavira, but he kind of traced his lineage back through Parshvanath back all the way to like Indus River Valley civilization days. And so according to the Jainists are the most ancient Indian religion, basically. And
I like the way you say
they
that.
and so they're like stricter Buddhists. And Buddhists, I mean, I have a theory that in a sense Buddhism is Jainism made more accessible to people. So where there was like a very strict path to become an enlightened person, to become a Tirthankara, there were 300 years in between these two Tirthankaras. They didn't meet in person. So like the idea of becoming an enlightened person was like very rare, and they would like starve themselves for 12 years and stuff. And so Lord Buddha was on a path where he was starving himself. I don't know how many years he did that, but then eventually he was like, you know what, I'm gonna have some rice. And the other people, the other ascetics that he was with, that I think he was teaching, or like, so I don't know, it's unclear, but I have a theory that he was actually a student directly or indirectly of Mahavira, and that he was learning that Jainist path, that old school Jainist path. And then he kind of went his own way and started his own thing. I don't know, you know, it's just a theory, but it's, and but he did talk about Mahavira, Lord Buddha. I haven't gotten to it yet in the scriptures, but I've read articles about it. And he basically considered them too strict. He said they were overly restrictive, you know. So he was like the Crowley of Jainism, you know, restriction is sin, do what thou wilt, shall be beholden. And so anyway, so yeah, no, it's a sort of joking-ish. Anyway, so there's the Buddhists, the Jainists, and then Guru Nanak, the Sikh path, and then the traditional, you know, Vedic Hinduism. There's Sarasvati and Hanuman and Ganesh and, you know, Lakshmi and Krishna and you know, so on and so forth, Shiva. And then there's Jesus and Mary and Michael and so on and so forth. And I would have a statue of Muhammad, but I value my life too much. You know, like, not supposed to do that. You're really not supposed to do that. You know, so.
Yeah. Interesting.
I do have a genie lamp, though. And
Oh, you
a
do?
Muslim prayer hat. I met a Malaysian Muslim in Nepal, and it's funny. He was praying. Have I told you this story? He was praying at like, I don't know, 4 a.m., 5 a.m., one of the five prayers that they do every day. And I thought he was in line for the bathroom. I got up because I had to use the bathroom, and there's this guy right outside the bathroom door kneeling, bowing toward the bathroom door. And I'm like, oh man, he must have to go much worse than I do, you know, like he really is waiting for whoever's in the bathroom. And so I'm standing there just kind of looking at him like, is this guy serious? Like, is he doing this for my sake, or is he like, he's really having a moment here? And I'm like, are you okay? And he's like, oh yeah, you know. And then we started talking, and then he mentioned about how he was praying. And then I was like, are they ever going to come out of there? And he's like, who? And I'm like, the person in the bathroom. He's like, I don't think there's anybody in there. And I was like, oh. And so I went inside. Anyway, he and I went to see the sunrise with a few other people a couple days later. And we were having breakfast, and he was talking about something, and I talked about how I like Sufis. And he's like, oh, you know about the Sufis? And which Sufis? I'm like, well, of course there's Rumi, but I particularly like Hafiz. And he says, "You know Hafiz? You know about his poetry?" And I said, the great religions of the world are sinking ships, and the poets are the life rafts. That is good for business, isn't it, Hafiz?" And he took off his hat and he gave it to me. So that's how I got my Muslim prayer hat.
Oh, nice. Wow.
So that's one thing I didn't just buy, you know, but I tend to wear that less on YouTube. So
I feel like that's
yeah. So there's an eclectic sort of ecumenical diversity to, like, the way I put it is mine is a Hinduism that embraces great masters like Lord Buddha and Mahavir and Guru Nanak and Prophet Muhammad and our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, you know. So why limit it? You know, I think if those Abrahamic religions had come in and said, "Oh, hi, nice to meet you. Hey, we've got gods too. Have you heard of Jesus? Have you heard of Muhammad? Have you heard of Allah and Adonai?" And, you know, they would have been like, no, how cool. What are they like? You know, I mean, at the very, maybe there would have been a little bit of, well, ours is better. You know, I don't know. People are childish. But if they hadn't come in and said, ours is real and yours is fake, and by the way, we're going to burn yours down because we've got an army, that's kind of where everything went south. And honestly, I think that's kind of where the limits were put on the definition of Hinduism, because they could have kept adding gods, you know, because, like, there were the tradition that, you know, the Rama and Hanuman come from one tradition, and Shiva and Parvati come from, I mean, I don't know, I'm speaking kind of from ignorance, but, like, it's already a mishmash of things. Like ancient Greek, whenever there'd be a war, then there'd be a change in the mythology. You know, Athena was the goddess of Athens and so on and so forth. And in Egypt too. And Catholicism, in a way, you know, they kind of borrowed some of those techniques in turning gods and folklore heroes into saints. And
Right. So you give an old force or an old concept a new framework. You know?
Yeah.
Hey.
Namely mine.
Yeah.
My own. Yeah. Oh, Bridget, she loved the Vatican. Oh my God. After she did that thing with the fishnets, she totally was doing the rosary right then and there.
So now we can have it. So now we can have, like, all these churches for Bridget. Hooray. And then you just
until
make sure
Martin
that
Luther
the kickbacks come back to Rome, okay?
Yeah. Until Martin Luther comes along and translates the Bible, then all these people are like, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
She's not in the Bible. Yeah. But he was cool about he thought you shouldn't burn statues and stuff. He thought they were useless. I mean, his criticism of statues was that when a person Martin Luther, when he said that when a rich person donates a statue of an angel or whatever to a church, they think they're doing a service for God, and they should have used that money to help the poor. And that's what's wrong with having images and statues in the church. Nobody's worshiping the fucking images. So, like, he's saying people are talking about the first commandment. Nobody's worshiping these statues. Right. Like, it doesn't apply. The first commandment doesn't apply here. But there is something wrong, but it's not what you guys think it is. And one person might actually get inspired by the statue in a way that helps them along in their path. And so we don't need to destroy them. Just let them be. Let people have their statues. You can build a church without statues if you want to, but the churches that are already there that already have statues in them, just leave them alone. Because people were going in and smashing the statues. And so he was bringing it up in a way. It's like, I don't like them, but don't make a rule that you're not allowed to have them. You know, he always had to. And I just found out Muhammad kept running into that. Muhammad, blessed be he, of course, you know, all that. He would tell people, if I don't talk to you, don't talk to me. Because he got sick of people asking him questions, and then based on his answer, they would go, you know, teach everybody that this is the new law from his mouth, you know. And so it's like everything he said would become dogma. So he was like, just don't talk to me. Like, if I have something to say, I'll let you know. And Lord Buddha has his way. It's interesting, all these different like people. And Martin Luther was, in a sense, kind of, I mean, he was kind of like a pope in a way. I mean, an unofficial one, but in a way more influential on what became Protestant Christianity than any individual Catholic pope was on the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, it's arguable, but I mean, it seems like a pretty true statement. Like, was it John the 28th that instituted Vatican II? That was a pretty big change.
Oh yeah,
I mean, he was an old guy too. They were like, let's just put in an old guy, and then when he dies, we'll figure out who we want to. You know, he's not going to do anything in
right,
5 years.
Yeah.
He comes in and he's like, okay, from now on, no more Latin. They're like, wait a minute. What's going on here? So Francis is being a bit frisky too. I guess there's been a falling out now, it seems like, with the Eastern Orthodox Church, now that Francis is so soft on the crime of being gay. And so the Orthodox are like, yeah, we're not interested in meeting with you next year. You know, we don't need to have our annual, or every so many years they were having like a East and West conference together. They're like, yeah, we're not going to do that anymore because you guys have gone astray. You know, like, sad, but growing pains.
Yeah,
even growing pains.
I had not heard about that, and I'm doing just fine after having not known that all this time.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in the Episcopal Church, they're like full on rainbow flag, and you know.
Yeah. At least the American Episcopals are like that. Like, it's like you have like, you know, you have like the English Church of England, which is much like Catholicism in a lot of ways. It's just they have different leaders and stuff like that, but they're still very traditional and very and they could be argued to be so traditional as to be almost
the king of England is the head of that church, and he wasn't allowed to get married in that church.
Oh really?
I mean, that's kind of interesting. Well, I mean, before he was the king, they refused to do it he wasn't divorced, he was a widower, but his wife was divorced. And so I didn't follow that too closely. Maybe they ended up giving in and doing the ceremony, but yeah, there was some controversy about it. And now he's actually the head of that church, so that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you have English Episcopals, and then you have American Episcopals, and it's like the American Episcopals.
Right.
Just
I think
like
they call them Anglicans usually.
Yes. Yes.
Like the Anglicans and the Episcopals.
Yep. Know. Yep. The Episcopals, like they just make decisions and they just run. And so they were like, how do we feel about gay people? And then they just decided it's fine. And
but then
they were just like, okay,
split?
It's fine now. What's
I
that?
I think there were some Episcopals that split off at that point. When they started,
oh, there probably like were
openly,
there probably
openly
were.
Lesbian ministers and stuff like that. So I did Lutheran Bingo in the most recent Martin Luther recital, where I made a bingo of like the things Martin Luther often says and does, and then read his lecture and marked when it, you know, like when he talks about the devil and when he, you know, like says this or that, then I only got one bingo out of it. I was thinking there'd be more than that because I was basing it on his previous lectures, and he tends to like change up because he's talking to the same group of people every day for 8 days. Mm-hmm. So he's not gonna like necessarily say all the same stuff he said before. So
have you heard about I'm really speaking out of turn here because I don't know much about this at all, but I have heard it said that Luther had some struggles with the devil, specifically like the devil would like show up in his room sometimes, in like his bedroom sometimes, and then like he would And then he would have violent arguments with the devil and try to get him out of the room and stuff like that.
That's really interesting. He seems to, I mean, when he talks about, I just thought he was being funny because he was like, if I say this, then the devil's going to say this. And I'd have to admit he was right. And I just thought he's just kind of being coy and funny about, like, but maybe he was schizo. I mean,
He
schizophrenic,
had a definite relationship with he had a definite relationship with the devil, or so I've heard.
He said, I know the devil very well, and I
Right,
know
and
how he
I think,
thinks.
right, I don't think that
Wow.
he was being metaphorical there. I think,
Wow. Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
At least it's if you're gonna get into Martin Luther, like it's an interest, it's a fascinating aspect of his thought. You know what I mean? That actually he had, he had very physical, visceral exorcisms of the devil, like on a regular basis.
Wow, how interesting. Yeah, okay. Well, I'll let
I mean,
because I'm
I'm
reading.
not saying I read that. I don't know where I got that from, but I read it in one source, and then I was like, "Oh, that's interesting." And then it just
Well,
sort of
I'll
moved on.
see. I'll keep an
So I
open
don't.
mind either way that and consider that maybe that's true. And I'll let you know if things start to corroborate that. But yeah, so far, I mean, it seems like based on what I've read, it could be that maybe somebody being very literal minded or is reading the same stuff that I'm reading and be like, he talks to the devil. He says he knows the devil, like this. But the way I'm reading it is like, hey, if I say this, then the devil would say that, and then I'd have to admit he was right, and it's just kind of
Right,
like,
and that's definitely like if somebody were to say that today, like that's definitely how you would interpret it, But I think that he was a lot more, he meant that a lot more literally.
Wow, that's very interesting.
It's a
Well,
super
it takes
interesting.
it would it I mean, he was very courageous to put himself in that position initially. Like once he did it and he had all these people come to support him, and then he was kind of like leader of the gang, then it's like, okay, yeah, he didn't need that much courage once he had like a small army behind him. But when he was alone, being the first guy to like, hey, I'm gonna break the silence and say some shit right now that everybody who's said anything like what I'm about to say has gotten killed in horrible ways. Like, something motivated him to do that. I mean, his sense that it was the right thing to do was strong enough to overcome his fear of being tortured to death. Like, and so, in a way, like the idea that maybe he was a little bit mentally divergent in some way or another, or atypical, is kind of like, yeah, maybe, because like so-called sanity, values survival before making a point, usually,
He's also Martin Luther was also like a lot more ascetic than, well, I shouldn't say that people realize, probably plenty of people realize it. It's just I was raised Catholic, so I don't necessarily know these things just off of my head. But one of his one of Martin Luther's bigger messages was if you're going to stand up and say something, make sure that you've knelt down and prayed for twice as long first.
That's interesting, yeah.
And that's another thing that he meant, like there's so many things that he said that he wasn't being metaphorical, he would pray for like a straight day before he would, before he would do like a lecture or something like that, so that he would make sure that he had the right frame of mind. And then the other thing was that if he wasn't in the right frame of mind, then the devil would show up and would start to, and would start to do all the things that the devil does for Martin Luther, right? Start to
I
instill doubt,
can,
like all of the.
yeah, I can relate with that in a certain sense. Though for me, it doesn't, it's not all played out in a in that egregore, you know, in that sort of like way of like angels and demons and stuff like that. But when I come out and say some stuff, even if nobody's listening, if I record myself talking about whatever, and then I start to second guess, or I start to like look at it through the eyes of other people in my own head, like what if so and so, who feels strongly about, you know, in this direction, were to see and hear me say that, you know, could be interpreted as being a direct contradiction of everything that they hold to be true and good. You know, like even if I disagree, I don't like the idea that that person might judge me from what I said. And so sometimes I go through this like storm of anxiety, this sort of kind of almost torturous self-doubt anxiety. And I could see if I were a little bit schizophrenic and very religious that that might manifest as Satan, you know, talking to me and telling me everything I did wrong. I mean, because he is the accuser after all, in the Old Testament sense. He's not just the bad guy in the movies, you know, like he's the prosecuting attorney, and you're on the stand, or you're the one, the defense. It's God versus you, and he's the prosecuting attorney, you know, I mean, in the Job sense, you know, in the. So you just have to develop a strong relationship with the defense attorney, which is, of course, Yeshua and Mary and so on. And that's why they call them that, my advocate, you know, like, please get me out of this. Can you bribe the judge or something, you know? Like, Mary has it in with the, never mind, I won't go there.
I wonder why why there is so much relation between between religion and law.
Oh,
Like, why is
yeah.
the Holy Spirit, you know, why is the Holy Spirit called the advocate? Why is Satan, the accuser? Like, what is this? Because like there's this I mean, like, astrologically, there's like a ton of correspondence there, right? Between the Saturn of judges and the Saturn of deep religion, right? Because like the this, I don't know, this just gets into my own thought about things. Like the Saturn as the judge is like, is, well, that's exactly what it is. It's Saturn as this restrictor of what you can and can't do, right? And that aspect of law. But then you also have the Saturn of like deep religion, that same sort of restriction. And then another really interesting aspect of that is that the according to medieval astrologers, the so you have you know how you have like the 12 houses, the you know the ninth house in the modern parlance of our times, the ninth house is the house of religion, right? In for medieval astrologers, it was also somewhat the house of religion, but it was kind of the house of spirituality. And if you were strong in the ninth house, you were considered a good astrologer. All this stuff is indirectly pointing at this idea that the ninth house is, it's the house of spirituality, and it's also the house of astrology. The secret there being that astrology is purporting itself to be a natural religion, right? Where like the whole idea of fate and the whole idea of the stars and the gods points towards an astral religion, and that the ninth house is actually like the religion of astrology is really that natural religion. It's the same, it's, and it's almost Ficino was a big purporter of syncretism. This idea that like Like you can study all of these various things, and they're all going to inform each other, right? Which is why Ficino was a Neoplatonist, and why he was also a Christian, and how he could like combine all this stuff, right?
Is it
The
House of Sagittarius? Sorry, I'm rusty with my houses. The ninth house is the one that
yeah,
corresponds
well,
with Sag.
the ninth sign is Sagittarius,
Right,
and the ninth
okay.
house is
In a
just the
natural
ninth.
chart, it would line up with Sag. Yeah.
Like if you were to put, if you were to put, so if you were to put like the
Sunrise,
astrological
spring
sign,
equipace, then Saturn
right.
is in
So if you were to put,
Sag
if
is
you
in
were
the
to put
ninth
like
house.
the first point of Aries on the horizon, and then you
Yeah.
had all the signs, then Sagittarius would be over the ninth house.
Right. Okay.
But
Got it.
the ninth house is basically right next to the 10th house. So the 10th house is the top of the sky. And then the ninth
Oh,
house.
okay. Is that the zenith that they talk about in the tarot?
Yes. The zenith is the cusp of the 10th house.
Okay.
So and the ninth house is just next to that zenith.
Right.
It's an interesting house because it's like so you have you know how you have angular succeeding and decayed houses? Maybe you don't.
No. Yeah.
Okay, you have so basically like if you have a chart, then like the east is over here and the west is over here,
Right.
right? This might be backwards if people are watching this,
Yeah, it's
but the
okay. If you have a normal chart, then you put it up on the southern wall and stands to the north of it, facing south at it, and then you can draw a line and connect it to the horizon to your
Yes.
left, and that'll be
Right.
east, and the horizon to your right will be west. Yeah.
Right. And then just watch the way that the sun moves, because that's one of the like solar movement is like the undiscussed elephant in the room when it comes to most astrology. Like it's this super weird thing that like okay, so like the whole concept of a chart, right, is the concept of the solar movement, not really the movement of other planets, because the other planets like generally follow where the sun is, but not completely. The moon does not at all. The moon like just plays its own game. The moon is in someplace
Yeah.
totally different. But the way that things are measured is through solar movement, right? And then even the concept of measure itself is solar. So like this idea of the idea of having something to measure in the first place is a solar
Right.
concept.
So the mansions of the moon and all that have to do with the moon's position in its own paradigm. But when it moves through the 12 zodiacals, isn't that based on the movements of the sun in a sense? Or am I confused?
In a sense, yes, because the mansions of the moon are regular, since they're regular divisions of the zodiac. So, like each of them measures
Oh,
like
okay.
a certain amount of degrees, right?
Okay,
So it's still like it's being expressed in the framework. There's that word again, in the solar framework, right? Even though the moon itself is someplace like way off, like someplace like totally different, but the whole idea of the ecliptic, the whole idea of ecliptic longitude, it's a solar thing. And like, so, okay, so it's a solar thing, right? But that, what that means is that all of the various, you know how like a little bit later on, like right before medieval times, when you get like Dionysius the Areopagite, people like that, you start to get these Neoplatonist ideas of angels, corresponding to zodiacal pieces of some kind, right? So you have like angels of the
Like the
signs, you have angels,
Shem.
right? Yes, you have like angels of the faces, you have like all of these different angels, and the concept of spirits being associated with particular pieces of the zodiac is actually a lot older. Like you can look at like Dendera and start, but you can look in like Egypt, ancient Egypt, and see aspects of this, right? But the whole concept of all of these different angelic schemes relate back to solar movement, right? So basically, all of these different hierarchies are all built on solar movement. Like all of it is based on, another way to say it is all of these are based on the seasons. And the question in my mind is why?
Right.
I don't know. I don't know why, so I don't know why, like lunar astrology wasn't more of a thing. Why did we
Well,
continue to believe in?
I think probably if I had to guess, it would be the practicality of the seasons and so forth. I mean, for as far as like the not necessarily the very fine-tuned, like, okay, let's find out exactly what this aspect is, like, but the farmer that's like, when do I plant? When do I plant? When do I harvest? You know, like, when do I board up the windows? When's that? What, you know, and depending on how far north you are, like, when's Christmas? You know, when's the point where I where the sun doesn't where the sun disappears for 3 days? And so yes, the sun is like the most immediate. It's hot when it's there too much. It's cold when it's not there enough. Where And then if it's cloudy, you don't even see the moon, you know. So I mean, you know, just on a very like, I mean, that isn't a very like academic, you know, intellectual reason why it's solar based. But perhaps, I don't know, there seems to be this sort of organic back and forth between the mundane reason and the idea level, you know. I don't know, maybe like with
Maybe.
language, like, why do we use that word for this? Oh, because the French conquered before the, you know, like this and that, like
Oh yeah.
the
Yeah, like
Vikings came
it could
here
be
and
just.
the Danish came here, so we use the Danish word for this, but we use the Viking word for that. And
Yeah.
so like in English, sometimes we get two different dialects of a French word that mean the same thing in French, and then we have the Nordic word and the Danish word, so we have four words that all mean the same thing. They all get incorporated into English, and they end up having nuanced, you know, meanings. And so we end up with four words for the same thing with a different connotation depending on which word you choose. It's very interesting how English has kind of just been a sponge like that. And it still kind of is. Like, it
Yeah.
absorbed juggernaut as a Hindi, come from a Hindi word. Pundit is
Oh,
a
I didn't
Hindi
know that.
word. Yeah,
Oof.
well, okay, interesting thing. The Jesuits would come to the pundits. The pundits are the priests, the ones that you go to. They're the astrologers. Now, interesting thing about India is if you're in a traditional family and you want to marry somebody and your parents talk to the local astrologer and the astrologer says their birth charts don't line up, they say, I forbid this marriage, you know, because the astrologer says so. So it's like astrology in the East versus the West. I mean, in India versus US, you know, very different demographics that take it seriously. I'll just say that. Anyway, and so the pundit is the one who, you know, is like the Brahmin at the temple. If you see him, he does the astrological chart. He says, you're going to be cursed unless you do 100,000, of this mantra, or you pay me to do it, you know. And it's like, well, can I pay you to do it? Yeah, you can pay me to do it. And so that's the pundit. And so the Jesuits would sit down with the pundits and figure out the meanings of these Sanskrit words, because the pundits were the ones that were expert in Sanskrit, like the priests in old Europe were the experts in Latin. And so the Jesuits knew, you know, Latin and Portuguese and probably one or two other languages from Europe, and they'd sit down with the pundits and work out the sand. So that was how they figured out Indo-European root languages. That was how they figured out that there's a common ancestor to Celtic, Germanic, Roman, Greek, and Sanskrit, and you know, Kentum well, I can't remember the word right now, but the word for hundred in Sanskrit is, it's an S instead of a C, which is interesting because it turned back into an S in English with the word cent. It was Kentum
Oh,
in
yeah.
Old Latin, but it's so like it's an S in the Sanskrit. So anyway, there's so many words that are just kind of like, oh, that it permutated this way in that language and this way in this language. And so there's like Hindi words that are kind of similar to like German words or English words, because they come from a common root. Anyway, so the Jesuits sat down with the pundits to do that. So pundit, or pundit with a U, it's A in Hindi and U in English, came to be a word for someone who's an expert in a particular field. But
Wow.
it was initially a priest who was an expert in the particular field that was Sanskrit. And so, yeah, it's trippy how, you know, and like the number one food in the UK is curry, you know, and things like that. So the English culture kind of absorbs, you know, I mean, it used to be by force, like when the French, I mean, who are the British anyway? You know, the Angles and the Saxons came, and then the French came, and then it all got mashed together into this thing that we now call English. And then they were in power, and they went out and conquered, but then they ended up absorbing everything they conquered. And so then now it's just this mishmash of cultures. And then people go around saying cultural appropriation, and it's like, where do you even start? And, you know, like, are we supposed to go back to speaking Welsh? Do we go back to speaking some Gaelic, you know, dialect? Because it's all appropriated from French
Right. I
and
mean, I'm
Norwegian.
sure
And
that
I mean, there's a specific context, like where you're dressing up like a rapper and making more money than the rappers, then it's kind of rude. But, you know,
you can
pulling an
just keep.
Elvis.
I'm sure that you could, regardless of what you want to go back to, you're going to find a way that that too is an appropriation. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
It
of
isn't a
course.
question of
You
whether it's
appropriated
appropriate.
your ancestors' DNA.
Wow.
Sharpened a stick. Yeah, the Neanderthals invented that. You know, no, I don't think it was the Neanderthals, but like, you got that from the Cro-Magnon, and they got that from the. So yeah, that book you're writing, you don't want to say too much about it, right?
Well, what's funny about it is so the original concept was to extract a whole bunch of so basically the idea is to extract a whole bunch of ideas that Agrippa has that are sort of embedded throughout the three books, because he does give like a full-on framework for how to work with magic in the three books. It's just scattered throughout it, and it's deeply embedded. Like you really have to dig to find it. And so I dug, and I found all this stuff, and what I'm starting to find is that he is essentially trying to make a reimagined version of Catholicism. He's essentially trying to do things like he's essentially trying to do things like baptize precious stones at the correct times to be able to produce magical effect, right? And
We used to do that kind of thing in the order, baptize talismans and
Oh,
under
right, yeah.
particular astrological influence, and
Yeah, it's all very Agrippan. But my thing is, so the original idea was let's rebuild the Agrippan framework and then apply it for a while and see what happens, right? But so one thing I ran into, so the thing I'm running into now is one thing that Agrippa says is that any magician should be blessed by the public religion for the laying on of hands. Now, that's an interesting thing to say. And In modern Catholicism, technically the only people who can, so there's laying on of hands, like
There's
healing.
apostolic succession in the
Exactly.
Catholic Church,
That's what he's
right?
talking about. He's not talking about like laying on of hands to like heal people. He's talking about apostolic succession. In order to be able to perform apostolic succession, you need to be, well, for apostolic succession, you need to be a,
Apostolically succeeded, installed, or something.
yeah, exactly. You need to
It
be a
has to have
bishop
been
in
done to
order.
you. Yeah,
Right. You need
as
to
I
be a
like to
bishop.
say that Jesus bopped Peter on the head, and Peter bopped someone on the head who bopped someone on the head, so and so and so and so on, down to you. That's
Right.
apostolic succession.
That's apostolic. Exactly. Exactly. In cases of like of healing the sick and that sort of thing, priests can actually do it too, but it's comparatively rare. Usually, like you need to be a bishop. That's
And I mean, I think apostolic succession, just sorry to interrupt, also includes not just Peter, but Philip and the others too, technically, right? So that's why when said that we all had to join an apostolic succession church, it was okay when became Greek Orthodox because, it didn't have to be Peter. Philip was okay.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Sorry, I interrupted you though.
No, it's okay. Well, problem one with that is that I'm not a bishop. So I don't like I even if I did rebuild an Agrippan framework, I couldn't really apply it because I'm not a bishop. I could become a bishop and then try to apply it. It's probably like, but that's more like a life goal thing. I
Well,
don't
it's
know that I
like
want to have that life.
I sit here in my monk's robe as a person who's not ordained, wearing a monk's robe, reading about the crime of wearing a monk's robe when you're not ordained and the penalty, and very seriously into the camera talking about, those phony people who put on monk's robes and act like Buddhist monks
Oh,
when they
yeah.
have no apostolic succession that goes back to Lord Buddha,
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
Yeah.
anyway.
That's like problem one is that Joe doesn't want to become a Catholic bishop. And so so I don't know that I want to actually apply this thing, right?
The Catholic bishops want to do Agrippan magic, so.
Probably not. Like if I could partner, if there are any bishops listening to this that want to partner with me, that's a totally different thing. Because then I can give them a framework and then they can apply it. Great. So that's
What
problem
about
one.
an Episcopal archbishop?
If they have apostolic succession, I would think that they would be fine.
Interesting.
I would
Interesting.
think that
If
they
you're
would be fine.
listening, very honored Frater
Oh,
AKHV.
yes, right. Okay. So problem
Sorry.
one. Yeah, problem one is that that magic is reserved for bishops only. But let me add a footnote to that. Problem two, our understanding of the laying on of hands is post 1570. It's post Council of Trent, right? In this thing was published in 1531, which is before Council of Trent. So that means that, and before the Council of Trent,
Was the Council of Trent before or after Nine Inch Nails? In other words, what's the Council of Trent?
Oh,
Sorry.
the Council of Trent was an ecumenical council that made decisions. So like the Latin verse, so one of the major decisions that came out of the Council of Trent was that masses before the Council of Trent, the way that you said mass depended on your diocese. It depended on what the bishop decided to do with Mass. After the Council of Trent, it was based on what the Pope decided should happen with Mass. So everybody started to apply the same order of Mass. And there was all of this catechism that came out of the Council of Trent just based on standardizing things, right? So since Agrippa came along before the Council of Trent, all of the things that he had to say about theology, about divinity, were all were all based on what was happening in diocese, not what was happening at the church level. So like, for example, the way that they did the laying on of hands in Cologne could have been different from the way that they did laying on of hands in Paris, which me and that means that when he says that the public religion must approve of your laying on of hands, that could just mean that like
Local.
that you're just a healer, that you're just somebody who heals the sick, and that a priest said that you could do this, and so you're all set. So it goes, so in that case, it's like, well, it's totally a laity thing. It's not a, you know, it's not, it hadn't been reserved to bishops only yet. Or it could be that it has been. Like, I don't know. So that research is going in this like heavy, like early Renaissance church history direction. I don't know. I want to go in that direction either. So I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what I want to do with this.
Well, I mean, you can go in a direction for a chapter, maybe even two, and then kind of like, well, okay, let's bring it back. There's an unresolvable, have you read Never Ending Story? There'll be
Don't think I've read the Never Ending Story.
Oh, it's so good. Oh,
Oh.
it's much better than the movie.
Wow.
But it's sweet. There's green text for Bastion and red text for the Never Ending Story, if I recall correctly. So there's like, if you get one of the original like prints, there's like different font, like for the whether you're reading the book inside the book or just reading the book, and
Oh,
the end
ooh.
of the movie is the beginning of the second half of the book, and it goes a completely different direction that has nothing to do with the sequel movie that they made. And Bastion like slowly starts to forget who he is as he's making more and more wishes, becoming the emperor, the master of Never. It's so good. Anyway, never did I say Neverland? That's not Never Neverland. No. Wonderland. What was it called? The Neverhood? No. Anyway.
The never ending story.
Yeah,
Let's
just the
just
story.
let's just
Wonder.
remember. So the
Wonderland,
dragon's name was
Fantasia.
about four. Fantasia.
Fantastica. In the book, it's
Yeah.
Fantastica. Fantasia in the movie, like the Disney movie. But anyway,
Right, that's
so they he'd go off on a tangent, and then at the end of that, then he'd say, and then she went off and did great things, but that's another story for another time. And then the next chapter is you're back on track to the A plot, and
Oh, I
so
see
you
what
could
you're saying.
kind of say, there's an issue though, is you have to be an ordained bishop, and then so on and so on and so on, and then okay, anyway, let's get back to it, like the astrology, the magic, what is this stuff, to be upfront about it, no need to hide it. There's an issue here where technically, if you're just a person who's really interested in this stuff, according to Agrippa, you can't practice it because you haven't been ordained by your local diocese. But on the other hand, he was speaking before the Council of Trent. Why not? Why not have a chapter that just kind of addresses all that,
The other thing that I could do is just like try to build up a framework and then leave it at the framework level. So the reason why, so it's really, I don't know, I think it's really interesting. The three books has this reputation as being this like foundational text of occultism. But as far as I can tell, like there wasn't anybody, like it was mostly just totally ignored after that. Like there wasn't like this order of priests that just decided that they were going to be Agrippa style occultists and just started in with like a secret order within the church that did this stuff. As far as I know, that never happened. And so like the three books is like in a lot of ways, the three books is like it's never been applied. And so like what I could do is present an analysis of Agrippa such that I can present the way that magic would actually look if you were doing things by the book, if you were doing things by the Agrippa in the book, you know, and then just leave it at that and just be like, I've never tried this because I'm a pain in the ass purist who doesn't think, who wants to like go all in or not at all, you know, and
Right.
of course, like another option is, well, just ignore that little piece of it and just be flexible enough to try out ingredients of this without doing the full on stew.
Well, okay, here's a question. Was Paul given his apostolic authority when he fell off the horse and saw the bright light, or did he have to go to Peter?
I don't think that was he
Did
ever
he go
given that
to?
question.
Yeah, exactly. Did he? So would Paul have even been able to do these, these rites, or he wasn't technically given any kind of apostolic succession, but he claimed it, and everybody seems to think he has it. All the people who have it talk like he's called the apostle, right?
And but is he only the apostle because he was blinded by the light? And then, it's an interesting way to think, because it's like so much of religion is, oh, this person suffered for this. So, and that suffering is like used as this marker of authenticity. This person suffered for this thing, and so therefore it's got to be real.
But it's like that same kind of deconstruction of like, well, who laid hands on, okay, well, we know Jesus said, Peter, you're the rock, but did it was Paul given his authority because he went and begrudgingly made Peter become his friend? Or, I mean, at least in the movie, I mostly know about their relationship from Anthony Hopkins and whoever the other guy was. Did you ever see that movie, Peter and Paul? It's a classic.
I don't think I have. I
It's
should.
sort of like the sequel to Jesus of Nazareth.
Jesus of Nazareth, too.
Anthony Hopkins, younger Anthony Hopkins as Paul. It's worth checking out, just to check out Anthony Hopkins in that role. You can imagine, Hannibal Lecter, talking about, yes, we're calling ourselves Christians and we're not circumcising, like that kind thing. And he, I don't, I mean, again, like I know most of my, I didn't read Acts. That's one thing that I started trying to read it and I was just like, I can't, like the Lotus Sutra, but I did watch that movie, and so I don't know how accurate the accuracy of the movie Peter and Paul determines how accurate the information in my head about early Christianity is. Because in the movie, Paul was having was going head to head with James. James was saying, all right, if you're going to convert people in Greece and Rome, they've got to at least adhere to the Ten Commandments. They've got to be circumcised and kosher, this kind of thing. Or like they've at least got to do this much. And Paul was saying, no, like, no, I talked to Jesus and Jesus says they just need to, I mean, he wasn't saying, like, he was saying, no, faith alone. They just need to have faith. Like they need to believe in Jesus and, I don't even know if he was baptizing people. Maybe he was, but
I don't know. It's a good question. It's a whole other thing, right? Like, how did baptism work back then?
But yeah, in Agrippa's reality, in Agrippa's, world, it looked a certain way. And so the rules that he put forth were based on the pre-Council of Trent, world he was living in. But you can kind of deconstruct aspects of the foundations upon which the world he lived in was the assumptions were made by looking into some of these questions too. That's interesting. Maybe, I don't know. I'm sure they've got it all sealed up like a drum. The apostolic succession, they don't let any leaks out, like, what are we getting into the Nag
There couldn't be rogue
Hammadi
bishops just around
now?
creating
Come on,
people.
like
Could
Bigfoot,
there? Could there?
Sasquatch, these other branches of human, humanoid. That whole thing. Like it's fun when they ask scientists, like, is it possible that this? And they say, well, It's extremely unlikely that this, you know, or it's in, that is basically impossible. And this is, you know, total hoax. This is just, and then they ask about Bigfoot and they're like, well, maybe, you know, like it is entirely,
oh, yeah.
It is possible that when the Bering Strait, when the ancestors of the Native Americans crossed the Bering Strait, it is possible that some other cousin of humans, Cro-Magnons, Neanderthals, you know, and so on, also crossed at some point and then hid in the Appalachian Mountains so effectively that nobody knows they're there, and except for sometimes one person will take a picture of them. That's actually possible. Like, it seems unlikely, but I can't go on record and say that no, definitely there's no Bigfoot, because there might be a Bigfoot, you know. It's like,
right.
What?
Right.
That's,
yeah,
really interesting.
Yeah. There, I think it was,
there
I
might
think
be
was...
a rogue bishop.
I'm pretty sure that, like, no less than Jane Goodall said that there's no reason to think that Sasquatch doesn't exist.
Yeah. Like, vampires, eh. Like,
right.
that was probably people making up stories based on seeing people with tuberculosis sneaking around at night with blood in the corners of their mouths and looking very pale. Like, that's more likely what happened there. But Bigfoot, could it be a very tall, hairy, homeless guy living in the woods? Yes, probably that's what it is. Could it be a different type of human? Less likely, but yes, could be that too. But you probably saw something.
All right, I gotta run.
All right, thank you very much. This was fun, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You have a wonderful evening.
All right. Until next time.
Okay. Until next time.